this wonderful place in Calcutta. My special thankfulness to each of you for attending this evening. To my dear God, Brother Hari Sori Prabhu. It is very special for me to be here as Calcutta is the birthplace of my beloved Guru Maharaj, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. By His kindness, His compassion, and His wisdom, He has given me ideals that are so deep, profound, that to live for them and die for them is the greatest fortune I've ever had. I was told to speak something about the book that recently I wrote. So with your permission, I will try. I was a teenager, perhaps slightly younger than most of you, in the 1960s in America. For those of you who know something about history, it was an extremely turbulent time. There was a war in Vietnam, and when you turned 18, unless you had very, very specific reasons to get away, then you were forced or drafted into the army. I witnessed my friends, older brothers of my friends, being sent to a bloody war that most all of us felt had nothing to do with America. It was useless, and we shouldn't be there. But still, either you go there and die, perhaps, or you get put in jail and perhaps never be able to get a job in your life. This was America in the 1960s. When you turn 18 years old, for most of us, these are the two choices. Either go to a war in Southeast Asia that you absolutely don't believe in and fight, or you go to prison and have your name blacklisted for the rest of your life. At the same time, African Americans ...99%... they were born in the ghetto and they died in the ghetto, and they had no choice because they had no rights. The Civil War of the 19th century abolished slavery officially, but still they had no rights. In many states, they were not allowed to go to the same colleges as white people. They were not allowed to use the same bathrooms, use the same drinking fountains, and were given practically no job opportunities except hard labor. What an injustice. in the so-called land of the free. Young people like you, at that time, by the millions, revolted. It wasn't right. There was a whole counterculture created. And there was literally an internal social war between a large segment of the young generation and the older generation and the establishment. There were riots. The American government was taking a hard line. In one college campus, Kent State University, there was a peaceful demonstration against the war. And the Homeland Military, the National Guard, opened fire and killed and wounded their own youth. Meanwhile, the African American people, Martin Luther King was fighting for civil rights, inspired by Mahatma Gandhi, in a peaceful way. He believed we have to overcome prejudice, injustices by boycotting without violence. But there were others who didn't have the patience to do that. They were violent. Almost every major city had massive riots and billions of dollars worth of buildings burned to the ground. There was a war in Vietnam and there was a war at home. I was watching all this, living in a very simple, peaceful little village 30 miles north of Chicago, and wondering, why? Am I just going to go along with all this? You can't just sit and watch. I was in high school and I knew at 18, I may go with a gun in my hand to fight and either kill or die. And that's the way my entire generation grew up, with those choices. And I saw my African American brothers and sisters and friends, how they were treated. And I saw a country that was so full of wealth. The 1960s were a time of great prosperity, materially. But I just didn't see meaningful, peaceful, fulfilling lives. There must be something more. You can have everything externally, but if you don't have something very, very deep and fulfilling within your own heart, there's no possibility of real happiness. Happiness is not a matter of possessing things or touching things. Happiness is a state of consciousness. Happiness is when there's a meaning, fulfilling purpose in life. And happiness is when there is love. Relationships where there is meaningful love. I could see this. The music of the 1960s were inciting revolution in search of love. I was affected. In a peaceful march against the Vietnam War, I was tear gassed by the Chicago police, and most of the people with me were beaten and arrested with clubs. I went on a civil rights march for the freedom of the African American people in Florida, and my fellow white brothers were throwing rocks and bottles at me for being on the wrong side. I was searching, but at a certain point I realized that the real solution has to be something spiritual. Political solutions, social solutions are like curing the symptom of a disease. You can put a salve on boils to relieve the pain of that boil. But if you have disease in your blood, it's going to keep coming again and again and again. Many people in my generation turned to drugs, alcohol, turned to totally free, unrestricted sex. Many turned to revolution, burning draft boards, fighting the government. Others turned to hippies, peace and love. But what was that peace and what was that love? They didn't know. Myself and one of my friends, Gary, decided to see how other people in other places see the world. So we decided to take a 3-month trip during our break from college to Europe to see how other people view life. What are their values? What is their idea of God? It was a growing experience. We had one friend who was the only one of the three of us with any money whatsoever. And the first day we arrived in Luxembourg, we got a cheap ticket by airplane for $65 from New York to Luxembourg. And the first day our friend was robbed, so none of us had any money. So he went home. But Gary and I were thinking, here we are, first time in our lives outside of our native country of America. We don't know where to go. We don't know a single person. And we have no money. And we were really excited. This is going to be a wonderful journey. Because we're looking for God, and now we're just in the hands of God. Where should we go? We wanted to go everywhere. We were young, 19 years old. We decided, do you know what hitchhiking is? Hitchhiking means you stand on the side of the road like this, and somebody might, driving by, might stop and pick you up. We decided, in order to put our lives in the hands of God, we would hitchhike. And whoever stopped to pick us up, wherever that person was going, that is where we would go. That was our itinerary. We traveled through many of the places of Europe, especially studying the cultures, the people, and the religions, Judaism and Christianity. Not only reading books, but meeting the people and discussing with them. When you have nothing, you really get to know a place. You're not just staying in a hotel and getting a tour to see the famous things. You're really with the people and depending upon the people and meeting people in the roadsides, and they invite you into your homes. This was our life. But as we traveled, not only reading books, but meeting the people and discussing with them. When you have nothing, you really get to know a place. You're not just staying in a hotel and getting a tour to see the famous things. You're really with the people and depending upon the people and meeting people in the roadsides, and they invite you into your homes. This was our life. But as we traveled, this spark of desire for spiritual experience was burning brighter and brighter and brighter. Until ultimately we were on an island in Greece called Crete. We lived in a cave. And there, I was climbing a mountain and meditating and praying and reading spiritual books from sunrise to sunset, fasting as well. And then at the end of the day, come back to the cave and meet my friend Gary, and we would discuss our experiences. One day was a special day. That spark grew into a blazing fire. I was praying and longing for spiritual direction. And in the midst of a beautiful sunset, I heard a voice within myself. It said three words: go to India. I believed it was the voice of God answering my prayer for direction. I remember wondering, how am I going to go to India? I have nothing. All I know is how to hitchhike. But I was determined to go. I came back to the cave, and I saw Gary sitting there meditating. Have any of you ever lived in caves? It's a very natural lifestyle, actually. I said to Gary, something amazing happened to me today. Gary said to me, something amazing happened to me today. I'm sorry, today. I said, really, what? He said, at sunset, I heard a voice. I said, really, you heard a voice? He said, yes. I said, well, tell me, what did he say? He said, this voice said, go to Israel. I sat closer to him. I said, what? Israel? I don't know if I heard you right. What did you say? And Gary said, don't you believe me? I heard a voice within me. Don't you believe me? I said, I believe you. But what did he say? He said, go to Israel. I said, well, he told me to go to India. There was dead silence for the next 20 minutes. By this time it was dark and the stars were in the sky. And I looked up in those stars and I remember speaking to the sky, talking to God. I didn't know who he was or where he was, but I believed he heard my prayers. I remember saying, yes, I am willing. And I told Gary, I'm leaving at sunrise for India. He said, what? How are you going to get there? You have to travel through the Middle East. It's very dangerous. You have no money. You don't know anyone. Come to Israel with me. We'll get a job for some time. Then we'll get money and take a bus to India together. But don't go now. It's too crazy. It's suicidal. But I told him that this calling in my heart was so loud and so strong, I could not say no. So the next morning, we were lifelong friends. From 10 years old, we were dear friends. We grew up together. We experienced the childhood play to the rebellion of the teenage years. We traveled through Europe searching for ourselves. And now we were parting ways. He was not ready to hitchhike to India. I never met a person from India in my entire life before I reached the border of India. And I didn't even have a map. But I believed if I just keep hitchhiking in the eastern direction, someday, by God's grace, I will arrive in India. So I left him and found a fisherman with a boat who took me to Athens, Greece, where I met two other travelers who said they wanted to go to India too. One had a little money, two of us had nothing. But we were told you can't go because there was a horrible cholera epidemic in Turkey. We hitchhiked sometimes 8 hours, no one picked us up. Finally, after 3 days traveling through Thessalonica, we reached the border between Greece and Turkey. The border guard told us in Greece, the border in Turkey is closed. You cannot go there. All there is between this place and the border of Turkey is a no man's land, a wilderness where there's no food. There's wolves and snakes, not even a drop of water. If you leave Greece, you cannot come back because we have closed our borders from Turkey due to cholera. And they will not allow you in. You will die in the wilderness. It took us 3 or 4 days to hitchhike to that place. And it was just about the sunset time. He said, "We're closing. I'm leaving now. Make up your mind now. But I warn you, don't go." And foolish teenagers as we were, we said, "We will go." He was very angry. Said, "But you cannot come back." We walked through that gate and it closed. It was becoming dark, very cold. I saw snakes slithering around. I saw some sort of a skeleton about 30 feet away to the left. And we walked and walked, and we heard the howling of wolves. And then we started to wonder, what if the border is closed in Turkey? It was several miles. And finally we came to the border. And there was one man there with a big rifle, a soldier. And he said, "Border closed." We begged and pleaded, but there was a massive steel fence with swirling barbed wire on top of it. There was no way to get in. And every time we begged, he just kept saying the same thing. "Border closed." But somehow or other, we got in. That's a long story. If you like, you can read the book and find out. We started hitchhiking. We got a ride on a flatbed truck with policemen on it. They took us to Istanbul. We arrived in the middle of the night. And the leading police officer said, "Where are you going to stay?" And we said, "We'd like the cheapest possible place because we have very little money." Our own one friend had a little money, so we had to go all the way. So he said, "Oh." And he told one of his officers. The officer, he was a junior officer, raggedy clothes. He took us through the night, deeper and deeper into the ghettos of Istanbul. We saw and heard people dying of cholera. It was horrible, epidemic. He took us to this old stone building. And when we came in, there were the cruelest looking gangsters I've ever seen. And I live near Chicago, so that's saying a lot. They made a deal with the policeman and took us upstairs, high up in these ancient stone steps, brought us to a room, and wanted to take all our money. We argued with them. They took out knives. It was very scary. But ultimately, they left. We locked the door. We put the bed in front of the door. But we knew they'd be back. There was no way out. There was only a three-story jump down to the concrete from a window. Anyways, they attacked us twice trying to get in to kill us and rob whatever little we had. It's a long story how we somehow or other got out of there. We continued our travels. I don't have so much time, I'll be brief, but I'll tell you a few incidents from this journey that enriched wisdom in my heart. Traveling through Turkey, traveling through Iran, where I left my friends, they left me in Mashhad, Iran, because I wanted to study the Quran and Islam. Now I was alone. Then went into Afghanistan, Herat, Kandahar. Kabul, many life and death situations, many beautiful situations, but it was very hard. I could only carry on because I had such a longing to come to India. Then after traveling through all of Afghanistan, overland, traveled through Pakistan and came to the Indian border in Ferozpur. There was a lady in a military uniform sitting at the immigration. She took my passport, very carefully investigated every page, and then asked me, "How much money do you have?" I just had a little cloth bag. I just searched through it, and all I had was some coins. And came to the Indian border in Ferozpur. There was a lady in a military uniform sitting at the immigration. She took my passport, very carefully investigated every page, and then asked me, "How much money do you have?" I just had a little cloth bag. I just searched through it, and all I had was some coins. What I was doing was I was saving, each country I went to, I was saving the lowest denomination coin they had, like 1 cent or 1 paisa. I had a few of those from Holland, from England, a drachma from Greece, a gulden from Holland, a pence from England. Total, it was equal to about 2 rupees. She said, "You need $200 minimum to enter India. That is our rule." I said, "I don't have that." "Then go back home. You cannot enter." I said, "Please. I just hitchhiked all the way from London. It took me 6 months to get here, going through very, very difficult situations. I beg you, let me come into your country. I want to understand your religions. I want to meet the yogis and the sadhus." She told me, "We have enough beggars in India. We do not want another one. Show me your money or go back." Now, to hitchhike all the way back, I wasn't inclined. So I begged her again. And two military men raised their rifles and shouted, "Go back." So I walked maybe about 20 meters where there was a neem tree. And I was sitting under that tree, just praying. I was very confused. I went back to that lady and begged her again, and she wouldn't even look at me. She ignored me totally. So I went back to the tree. Would you like to hear this story? Thank you, thank you. So I went back about 3 times, and finally she put her finger in my face and said, "Don't test my patience. Get out from here." So I was thinking the worst she could do is put me in jail, but to put me in jail, she has to let me in India. But she wouldn't let me in. So I sat for hours and hours until finally it was getting towards sunset and there was a shift in immigration agents, and a tall Sikh gentleman with turban, military color, he took her place, and she told him, "Don't let him in," because I was still sitting under the tree. And she drove off in a jeep. And then I approached that man, and as soon as I walked up, he says, "You are a nuisance. I've already been warned against you. Show me your money or get out from here." I started to cry. I've traveled 6 months through the deserts of the Middle East to come to your great country. I want to learn about your heritage. I want to learn about your culture. I want to study from your rishis. Please, give me a chance. I never could imagine that I would not be allowed in the land of my dreams, the land of my prayers, the land I risked my life for, because I don't have enough money. with tears from my heart, coming from my eyes, I said to this officer, I promise you, just give me a chance, and someday I will do something good for your people. His heart softened. He took my passport and stamped it. He put his hand on my head and he said, "May you find what you are crying for. Welcome to India." I went to the Himalayas. Near Rishikesh, I was sitting on the bank of the Ganga. I had very long hair halfway down my back. I had regular Western clothes, gray striped jeans and a striped turtleneck shirt. And I was sitting on the bank of the Ganges meditating for hours and hours and hours. I saw one sadhu approaching me in this very secluded place. He looked very effulgent. He was looking down and the sand and the rocks of the Ganga bank. Then he approached me. He said, "You do not know who I am, but I have been watching you, and I see you have determination. Now take off all your clothes and throw them in the Ganga, and I will give you the robes of a sadhu." I asked him, "What is a sadhu?" He said, "It is a wandering monk who searches for God and truth." So I took off my clothes. It was the only clothes I had. I didn't have a second set. And I offered them to the Ganga. And then I put on a lungi like this and a chadar like this that he gave me. Two pieces of cloth. And then he whispered something in my ear. Something prophetic. He said, "The Ganga is your mother. Someday you will understand what I'm saying." And then he left. I never saw him again. But I sat on the bank of the Ganga. Actually, I sat in a rock in the middle of the Ganga from sunrise to sunset for about a month, meditating and praying. So many beautiful realizations Mother Ganga revealed to me. Watching her beautiful aqua water flowing, I was thinking, every wave, how it's swirling, its beauty. It cannot be duplicated by any artist as it really is. And yet, all this beautiful artwork of Ganga's flow, it disappears as soon as it appears. Isn't this like life? Everything is in a constant state of transformation. The current of the Ganga is forever. But all the manifestations of the waves in the Ganga are always changing. And I was thinking, on the banks of these rivers, what history has happened? There was the days of great spirituality in the Aryans. There was the Mughal invasions. There was the British invasion. Then there was Mahatma Gandhi and Subhash Chandra Bose and the Indian freedom movement, who somehow or other gained independence from the British. Sometimes slavery, sometimes freedom, sometimes war, sometimes peace, sometimes prosperity, sometimes poverty. Everything's changing over the years on the banks of these Ganges. But yet the current of the Ganga remains the same, flowing toward the sea. Truth is unchangeable, although everything around us is constantly changing. From birth to old age to disease to death, that's the nature of all bodies. But the soul is eternal, and truth is eternal. I was thinking, if I'm inside the water of the Ganges, I'm completely affected by everything happening there. But if I'm sitting on the rock, I can see with detachment. Similarly, when we connect to our self, to our true spiritual nature, then we observe the mind. We observe the world with detachment. Many rocks, many mountains are blocking the way of the Ganga, but yet she goes over, under, or around all obstacles to reach the sea. What a lesson in life. If we want to reach the sea of our true aspiration in life, we have to have the determination and the patience to somehow or other go around, under, or over all the inevitable obstacles that will come before us. At the end of a month of fasting, just eating one carrot a day and drinking a lot of Ganga water, somebody gave me a rupee. At that time, a rupee was worth, by American standards, not very much. And there was a vendor who was selling peanuts near the Chotiwala restaurant in Rishikesh. And I gave 1 rupee for peanuts. I thought I'd get this many. He started putting newspapers together, making a bag, this many peanuts for 1 rupee. I was thinking, I can really have a feast. And I really liked peanuts too. So I was walking back to my cave through the jungle, and on the path came a big brown male monkey. And he looked at me and showed me his teeth and started making these really scary sounds. And this was a culture shock for someone from the suburbs of Chicago. And suddenly, he just leaped right at me. I saw his eyes were looking into my eyes as he was literally flying toward me. And he was really big. And he grabbed the bag and then with his feet kicked my chest. And I fell back and he left with the peanuts. A few fell on the ground. And I went to pick them up, and then another monkey ran, picked up all the peanuts and left. I was not spared a single one. And then I was thinking, compared to the spiritual experiences that I had, all material acquisitions, fame, prestige, money, all of this stuff, it's all like peanuts compared to even a slight spiritual experience. And in this world, people lie and they cry and they die for these peanuts. But they do not know that at any moment, the monkey of time, the monkey of another person's greed, or the monkey of death is going to steal all these precious peanuts away from us. Now is the time to really search for a spiritual path to follow. This was my realization. I was meeting many yogis and gurus, some very famous, some the world will never know, but they were very special. One Kailash Baba, he taught me how to live in the forest, how to eat, what herbs, what leaves are edible, how to beg, how to deal with snakes and scorpions and leopards when living in caves. He was a very nice man. I live with Naga Babas. The way they taught me lessons were quite extraordinary. Anandamayi Ma, who was then the guru for the Prime Minister of India, Indira Gandhi. She was like a mother to me at that time. For some time I lived in a cave with a very great yogi named Tatwala Baba. He would sit sometimes for 10 hours at a time without moving, absorbed in meditation, samadhi. He wanted me to spend the rest of my life with him. And he was such a powerful mystic, I was afraid to say no. But at the same time, my heart wanted to see more, wanted to learn more before making this decision of my path. I left him. I'll tell you a couple more. Would you like to hear a couple more instances? Okay. After I took leave of him, I crossed the Lakshman Julan Bridge, started heading north to the higher Himalayas. Suddenly I came into a leprosy colony. And these lepers were in rags. They surrounded me. They were screaming in my face, "Bakshish, bakshish." I had no money. And there was about 20 of them around me. They wouldn't let me move. They kept screaming, "Bakshish, bakshish," and putting their fingers, their fingerless hands in my face. They were so desperate. Some of them were sleeping in holes in the ground because it was still cold, and they were covering themselves with dirt to keep warm. This was another culture shock for an American boy from the suburbs. 20 minutes, they kept me like a prisoner. And I was thinking, will I catch leprosy and have to be with them? I didn't know. I was tormented. Finally, they let me go. I took a couple steps. Then I saw a lady. Due to leprosy, her nose melted into her face. She had no fingers. She was dying. but she looked at me with such motherly love. She folded her fingerless hands to offer her pranams. And I could see in her eyes someone that just wanted one thing in life. She had such love in her heart that she wanted to share with someone. She just wanted someone in this world to accept her love. We all have a need to love and be loved. She wanted to be a mother for someone, even for a second. She put out her hand to bless me when she saw that I was gazing in her with affection. I was so moved that I ran over to her and put my head under her hand. And she said in Hindi, "May God bless you, my child. May God bless you, my child." And I looked up at her, and she was weeping in joy. Her face was illuminated with happiness. She was one of the most beautiful people I had ever met. All she wanted was to be a mother and bless a child. I left that place and went back to the bank of the Ganges, little north in the Himalayas, and sat on the bank and was trying to ponder what lesson is coming from this. I looked at the surface of the Ganges. And I was thinking, I'm seeing waves. Every now and then I see a little fish jump. But what's underneath? Beneath the surface of the Ganges, where I cannot see, there's entire dynasties of fish. Civilizations, you may say, of millions and millions of fishes that are being born, that are going through their youth, their old age. So many plants. Isn't life like this? That leper woman, on the surface she seemed like a diseased, poverty-stricken person. But beneath the surface she was a loving mother who simply wanted to love and to give. How easy it is for us to judge people on the basis of physical appearances or even emotional states. But is everyone not essentially a part of God? If we look beneath the surface of what we may hate about someone, we may understand the reason why they're like that and feel sympathy for them. We have such a tendency to see people according to their upadis, black or white or brown or red or yellow, man or woman, all different types of religious affiliations. We label people accordingly. Bhagavad Gita tells, Vidyavanaya sampane brahmani gavihastini suni chaiva swapake cha pandita samadarshana. Of course, I learned this verse later. But the same principle I was learning. That if we really look for the essence, every situation is an opportunity. We can convert curse into blessing or blessing into curse if we just look beneath the surface to see what opportunity there is to grow. To learn. I carried on my travels, lived in Uttarkashi in a cave for some time, where I began to study the animals, because they were the only ones around. Studying the leopards, the snakes, the scorpions, the monkeys, the mongooses. My poor parents, they were expecting me to return to college. But I was in a different college, and these were my professors. I traveled Himalayas for some time, came down to the plains. I met with Dalai Lama, Mother Teresa in Calcutta here, observed the puja in Kalighat. I lived in Bodh Gaya and studied Buddhism under Buddhist masters. I'm just going to tell a couple stories now. I went to Patna, where I lived in a Ram temple with Ram Sevak Swami. It's a beautiful story. What happened there was life-changing to me. But I don't have time to tell you, but it is in the book. He was about an 85-year-old man. I was 20 at the time. When I was leaving him, he wanted to give me a gift. He gave me his own walking stick. And he said to me that the stick of the mercy of a devotee can protect you from the greatest dangers. I didn't know what he meant, but I took the stick, rode on top of a truck to Raxaul, crossed the border, got another truck to Kathmandu Valley. I was living in a place called Bodhanath. Actually, I'm sorry. I'll get to this. I'll tell two more stories, maybe. When I came off the truck, it was the middle of the night and really dark. And the truck left, and I was all alone. I was in a village somewhere in the outskirts of Kathmandu. And I just started walking. I didn't know which way to go. I was alone. Suddenly I heard the howling. And this dog ran up to me and was barking ferociously. And I remembered what traveling sadhus would tell me. That one of the great dangers of being a mendicant is packs of mad dogs. They're so hungry, especially at night, they will tear you apart and eat you. When he howled, five or seven other dogs attacked. They came running and howling. They were foaming at the mouth. Some of them had rabies. And they were so mean. They were showing their teeth and they were barking so cruelly. And just in case any of you were sleepy. And I saw a wall behind me, so I just put my back to the wall. And they surrounded me by three sides and jumped on. And I had the stick. So I was beating them off with sticks. One at a time, they kept jumping, leaping at me. And I was young. Plus I used to play baseball, something like cricket. So I was beating them and they kept charging at me and charging at me. And the more I beat them off, the more angry they became. How am I going to get out of this situation? I was getting tired. And they were smelling my flesh and blood and becoming more enthusiastic. I didn't know what to do. I just kept beating them and beating them and beating them, but they were relentless. They would never stop. Then I saw a little distance behind me, there was a door. I happened to turn my head around, and I just backed to that where that door was and prayed to God, whoever he was, let this door open. And I turned around really fast and the door opened and I jumped in and closed the door, slammed it shut, and the dog started leaping on the door and barking and howling. They wouldn't leave. I didn't know where I was, but it was pitch dark. Suddenly a lantern flared and a family was sleeping on the floor and they saw me, an intruder, and screamed at me to get out. But I didn't speak Nepali. They didn't speak English. They thought I was a robber. One of them picked up a sword and charged at me. And I fell on my knees. It's a long story, but you can read the book if you like to. A few days later, I was in Bodhinath. And I was meditating. It was the monsoon rain season. A beautiful sky. It was so peaceful. Suddenly, I heard somebody walking. A really crude type of steps, too. And I came out of my meditation, and there was this huge European tourist who was carrying a bag of groceries. And he was obviously some sort of bodybuilder because he had gigantic muscles all over his body. He was probably about 6'3". And as he was walking with his bag of groceries, a gang of little monkeys surrounded him. And they showed their teeth. And they were just, they didn't leap on him. They just looked like they were about to leap on him. And they kept making these screeches and making these really nasty faces at him. And this gigantic bodybuilder was terrified. He was shaking. He held the bag of groceries in one arm and picked up a huge rock and started whirling it around and howling, "Rah!" And they just looked at him like, "Yee!" And ultimately, he was so scared that one little monkey just took the bag right out of his hand, took it away, put it down, and all the other monkeys started going to the bag. And he just ran away. That's only the beginning of the story. Now those monkeys were so tiny. What can I say? Then a little Nepalese boy. He was about 8 years old. So skinny and small. He was just kind of dancing through the field. And he happened to see the monkeys with the bag of groceries, and he picked up a stone and charged at the monkeys, and all the monkeys were terrified. They went, and they all scattered and left, started jumping in trees. And the boy sat down and started eating the groceries. I was thinking, what just happened here? That little boy is not even the weight of one bicep of that European man. But there was a lesson. The monkeys knew that you can conquer someone if you find their weakness. And his weakness was fear. The little boy, he grew up with monkeys. He had no fear of them, so they were afraid of him. The big wrestler, He didn't grow up with monkeys. We are afraid of what we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen after death, so we fear. Fear is vulnerability. There is a saying, there's nothing to fear but fear itself. Knowledge brings light. In darkness there is fear. Spiritual and light of them. So they were afraid of him. The big wrestler, he didn't grow up with monkeys. We are afraid of what we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen after death, so we fear. Fear is vulnerability. There is a saying, there's nothing to fear but fear itself. Knowledge brings light. In darkness there is fear. Spiritual enlightenment is the path of rising above fear. One day, it was during the monsoons, I was living in Swayambhunath in Nepal, and I decided to walk to Kathmandu and then walk back for no reason at all. As I was walking back, big dark clouds started forming in the sky. And it started drizzling. I knew it was going to be a major downpour. But all around me were only rice paddies with a very thin walkway between the paddies. I was walking. I was looking for a tree, looking for shelter from the rain, but there was nothing. Then I saw what appeared to be a little old man with an umbrella a distance ahead walking. Before the downpour came, I walked as fast as I can on that slippery little passage between rice paddies, slipping and sliding. And I nestled right behind that person with the umbrella as the rain started pouring. We walked about 10 or 15 minutes. Two strangers in the middle of a rice paddy under a single umbrella during a monsoon rainstorm. And there was nobody else around. Then the rain stopped. And I said, thank you. The person, for the first time, he turned around. He looked at me and dropped his umbrella in the mud. I looked at him and gasped. It was Gary, my lifelong friend, who I left in the island of Crete. Somehow or other, God brought us together there. And I told him, Gary, I will teach you how to be a sadhu. Come with me. And we were going to Amarnath for a pilgrimage. And we were riding on third-class trains. In those days, it was very, very crowded. In fact, it was so crowded that no ticket collector could get in to ask for a ticket. So sadhus taught me you could ride for free anywhere. But there's a price, not in rupees. We were crushed without sitting down. There was a flood in the rice paddy, and the train couldn't move for about 20 hours. Finally, it was a steam engine. This was in 1971. It was August. Oh, how movement feels good when you're stagnant for so long, with no air to breathe, with no food or water. And finally, at about 5 o'clock in the morning, the train stopped at a station. And Gary and I decided we have to go out and find some water and we can breathe nice air again and move. So we climbed over people, crawled out a window, drank some water at a local fountain, breathed air, moved around, then the whistle blow, and the train started moving, and we tried to get in a window, but it was a solid wall of people. We tried to get into the doors, solid wall of people. We could not get in that train. It was gone. Gary looked at me and said, "Now what?" I said, "I don't know." I walked over to a few sadhus who were sitting down, and I asked, "Where are we?" And the sadhu stood up as if he knew me. He said, "This is Mathura, Krishna's birthplace, and today is Janmashtami, Krishna's birthday." That is how I arrived in Vrindavan. A few days later, Gary left for the Himalayas. I told him, "I'll meet you there in 3 days. I want to stay here." But in that 3 days, I got typhoid fever and could not travel. Krishna would not let me leave Vrindavan. And during the time I was there, my heart was transformed. I found my path, the path of bhakti. And it was there, after so many months, that I met my Gurudev. And in his words, I found the essence of all the great teachings that I had ever learned from all other scriptures and spiritual masters. But the culture of bhakti, Srimad Bhagavat, Bhagavad Gita, was so deep. The love of Radha and Krishna, the path of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, was the deepest, richest, fullest, most satisfying philosophy and experience I had ever encountered. So I gave my heart and I gave my life. The treasures and the beauty of the culture of India is so deep and so great. This book is to share with the world what the people of India gave me, and especially what my beloved Gurudev, who's from Calcutta, gave to me and gave to so many millions of others. Many of you are young students. My sincere and humble request: you may be getting your degrees. You may become engineers, doctors, big business people like Mr. Mufflal. These are wonderful tools. You may be stationed in Calcutta, you may go abroad for your work. But my humble request is, in whatever you do, don't lose the most precious thing you have: the heritage of the Bhagavad Gita, the heritage of the Srimad Bhagavat, the culture, the spiritual culture of India. The world desperately needs it. There is so much stress, so much anxiety, so much unrest and pollution. Despite all our technological advancement, this world needs people of strong spiritual character, not sectarian fanatics, but people who deeply understand the science and philosophy of spirituality, which is so beautifully portrayed in the Bhagavad Gita. if you build a house, beautiful house, like this building. It's a beautiful building. People may say, nice architecture, nice paintings, wonderful furniture. But how many people say, great foundation? No one will ever say that. In any place, this has a great foundation. But the fact is, the foundation is holding up everything else. If the foundation is not strong, a storm can knock it all down. We may have great educations. We may have great professions. We may be very successful, or we may be very simple. But what is all important is we have an internal foundation based on spiritual principles and truth. Then the storms in life, whatever we build in our life, it will remain strong and firm. In fact, the storms of life will help us grow deeper with wisdom, realization, and satisfaction. The most fundamental need of all living beings is to love and be loved. And the origin of that is our love for God or Krishna. So please, as you grow and you develop in your careers, keep simultaneously digging deeper and deeper for that treasure within. The people of India, this great land, have the greatest heritage of spirituality in the world. And people from all places throughout history have come here to find it. Please don't lose it. Discover it within your own culture, within yourself. In fact, our Gurudev, Srila Prabhupada, he said that so many Indians are running to the West for things. But if people from the West come and say, here's bhakti, here's Krishna, here's Bhagavad Gita. He said, oh, if people of the West like it, it must be good. Please don't lose it. Discover it within your own culture, within yourself. In fact, our Gurudev, Srila Prabhupada, he said that so many Indians are running to the West for things. But if people from the West come and say, here's bhakti, here's Krishna, here's Bhagavad Gita, he said, oh, if people of the West like it, it must be good. The world needs what you have. Access it and share it. And we could make positive change in a world of turmoil. And that was my hope of writing this book. And I thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Maharaj. And before we go on to the special part of tonight's program, guess what you were waiting for? Kirtan! There are a couple of announcements.